including the conversation we're going to have now with Gail Trotter, who's got a piece up over at the Daily Caller about the link between the historical link between tyranny and gun control. Gail, it's good to have you back on the show. How you been? Happy New Year.
I'm great. Happy New Year, Steve.
So, Gail, let's start. Is there a historical link between gun control and tyranny, historically?
Yes. As you know, the 20th century was a very devastating century for innocent civilians. And if you look back at the sweep of history, during that 100 years, we saw 70 million people, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, who were murdered by genocidal and oppressive governments. And there was this really fascinating brief that was filed with the United States Supreme Court when it was hearing the D.C. versus Heller case, which was a pivotal Second Amendment case. And the brief outlined research that showed that the cause of these 70 million people who were killed by their governments, the cause was gun control regulation. And if you look at the history of what happened to citizens in countries like Turkey, in China, in the Soviet Union, and obviously the most famous example is Nazi Germany, you can see this progression. It's a three-step process. You have the beginnings of gun control regulations, which lead to gun registration. That's the first step. The second step is gun confiscation. And the third step is mass oppression or genocide. And it was really interesting in this brief because it took examples where citizens had access to firearms against some of these genocidal regimes, and the survival rate of citizens from these areas where they did have the benefit of being armed, the survival rate was higher. So there's a direct link between citizens who are armed having the ability to defend themselves against tyrannical governments and having a higher survival rate than these civilians who are not armed.
Let's take these one by one. The first step you mentioned was gun registration. Why does it start there? And what's wrong with just saying, hey, we know who everybody is who drives a car, right? I mean, so what's wrong with that? Why is that the first subtle step?
Right. Well, if you think about it, there are over 300 million people who live in the United States. And there's about an equal amount of firearms that are in the United States right now. But the government right now doesn't know who has the firearms and who doesn't. So, and neither do the criminals, which is a different topic, but the government doesn't have easy access to being able to track down who is taking advantage of their Second Amendment rights to defend themselves and their families. So once you have some small amount of registration requirements, then the government has an immediate database where if they change the law, and usually it's not a law where they say, we're going to outlaw every single firearm. It's done by drib and by drab. So once they have the registration, then they outlaw a certain type of firearm, and they have immediate information of who all the law-abiding people are who own that firearm, and then they generally give them the choice of either selling the firearm to somebody that's been approved by the government to be a repository of the firearm, or they have to surrender it to the government, and that's confiscation. So what I think is really interesting in this brief, it outlined how it happened in Nazi Germany. There was a government in Germany that preceded the Nazi government. It was called the Weimar Republic. And they had what President Obama keeps calling reasonable gun restrictions. And it was a very, anodyne, something that, like President Obama said last week, these are just very modest proposals. And the Weimar Republic put those...
Aren't they always, Gail? Very
right.
Modest proposals. They're always
right.
That way.
And you feel like you can't possibly disagree with it because, like you said, people say, oh, well, we register our cars. Why wouldn't we want to register our firearms, too? But in this example with Nazi Germany, the Weimar Republic put in these laws. Then when the Nazis came to power, they were able to selectively enforce the laws against a disfavored minority population, which in Nazi Germany's case, it was many different groups of people, but specifically the Jewish community. The laws were enforced against them, and then Jewish communities found themselves unarmed, most of them, against the death machinery of the Nazi government.
Confiscation. What would that look like here? Tell me if you would stipulate that this is true. You would agree with me that if by executive fiat Obama could order confiscation, he would. But it requires a bureaucracy layer that would have to acquiesce to that. And a lot of those are state and local sheriffs and other law enforcement officers who are, or at least their departments, their department heads and or branches are directly accountable to the voters. And that's why he hasn't done it. You agree or disagree with that?
I agree, and I think why we don't see it in part is because the way I would see that this administration would try to do it is that they would declare a certain type of firearm or a certain class of firearm as being just too dangerous for the American people to have, for civilians to have, and then it becomes against the law. And there is a idea that somehow the government collects it, or what the left likes to euphemistically term it is government buyback, which is really a confiscation just by another term. And once you have that law there, any law-abiding citizen who defies the law is put in legal jeopardy. So if you have whatever firearm it is that the federal government has outlawed and you continue to keep it, then you put yourself at legal jeopardy, and that has a chilling effect on everyone, every other law-abiding citizen who doesn't want to get in trouble with the law.
Is this something that you could see happening through the legislative process in your lifetime in America?
Well, some people say it couldn't happen here, and they'll say we have a constitutional system, and if you think about it, the constitutional system that we have, all of our rights are undergirded by the Second Amendment. So it's like a circular argument by the people who support these increased gun control restrictions, because they're saying, oh, it could never happen here because we have constitutional protections. But those constitutional protections are dependent on the Second Amendment. And my answer to people who criticize this and say, oh, it could never happen here, I respond, it already has happened here. Just look, before the Civil War, we had black people who were enslaved, and they were by law not permitted to own or possess firearms. And that was in part how they were able to, or how they weren't able to overthrow their oppressors. And then after the Civil War, the Southern states kept that policy and tried to make it very difficult for black Americans to own or possess firearms. And you contrast Southern black Americans' experience with Northern black Americans who did have ownership and possession of firearms. The Northern black Americans were able to resist angry mobs that would try to track them down and harm them. And unfortunately, the Southern black Americans had to deal with lynchings and oppression by the KKK. So it's already happened here.
Attorney Gail Trotter is here with us talking about her new piece over the Daily Caller, linking the history of gun control with tyranny. We'll talk more with her about that and apply that to what's going on in America today next. All right, back here with Gail Trotter, attorney, who's got a new piece over at the Daily Caller in response to the president's illegal executive orders on gun control that came out last week, which I think the Associated Press said wouldn't have stopped a single one of these madmen shootings that have been bedeviling our culture over these last few years. But, Gail's having a deeper conversation here. The link between gun control and tyranny historically. Gail, is this why the old line goes, this is why the Second Amendment comes after the first, right? Because those existential freedoms of religion, of speech, of conscience, of association, of the press, those things aren't worth the paper they're printed on if the people don't have the right to keep and bear arms.
That's absolutely right. And take the example of the Armenians. People are aware that the Armenians suffered a genocide about 100 years ago. We had the Ottoman Turkish government that did not approve, did not support, did not look kindly upon the Armenian community living in Turkey at the time. And the Ottoman Turkish government enacted Article 166 of the Ottoman Penal Code in 1911. It was restricting the individual right to keep and bear arms. And then the Turkish government targeted the Armenians to try and confiscate their weapons because they were a disfavored minority. And then the Armenians were sent packing to concentration camps, where they were told, if you don't go to the concentration camp, then you will be killed. And they didn't know at that point that the concentration camps meant death for them anyway. And then the Turkish government murdered over 1 million of these Armenians. So it was that three-step process that we see over and over again in the 20th century of first you have these, you know, reasonable gun control regulations, restrictions that lead to registration, and then step two, you have the confiscation, and then step three, you have mass oppression and genocide.
What are the remedies then? You're an attorney. Obviously, you care about this issue. You know the law, the Constitution. Well, let's face it. We can't assume that attorneys know the law and the Constitution in this day and age, but I'm assuming that you do. So what are the remedies here?
There has to be a continual pushback, not only against President Obama's agenda, these executive actions, which have their own bad ramifications for separation of powers. I mean, we know President Obama talks often about using his pen and phone when he can't get legislation through Congress that he supports, but the vast majority of Americans support. But apart from that, just trying to avoid this type of mixed up relationship between the individual citizen and the government, we have to understand that there has to be a loud message against these voices that would go out there and say it's unreasonable not to want to register your gun. And I even read this ridiculous opinion piece, I think yesterday or over the weekend, by a mother who works for maybe the Baltimore Sun, saying everybody needs to be able to register their firearms and put it online so that she could tell where firearms were in homes so that her child would be banned from going to people's homes who had firearms. Now, that message is saying that a firearm in the home is more dangerous than if there was no firearm, but that's not actually true. For example, pools, swimming pools in people's homes, which there are many people have swimming pools at their homes, they are 100 times more dangerous to small children than a firearm in the home. So I think people have to get informed about these statistics and facts and push back against this agenda, because the goal here is not to keep Americans safer. It is to implement what I see as a change in the relationship between the American citizen and our federal government.
Gail, good stuff. You have any resources you want to direct our audience to along the lines of tonight's conversation?
Yes, you can find a lot of information, all these stats, statistics and data that I've been talking about at my website, GailTrotter.com, G-A-Y-L-E, Trotter. You can also follow me on Twitter. My name is my handle, G-A-Y-L-E, Trotter.
Great stuff, Gail. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Steve.
All right, great to be with you as well. I mean, that's a history lesson. In fact, one of the movies we watched for our weekly family movie night last year was The Sons of Liberty, the old Walt Disney film. And one of the things it depicts is one of the issues that sparked Lexington and Concord is the Redcoats came to the Colonials and said, hey, we know you Minutemen have these munitions dumps that you kind of keep for a rainy day or, in, you know, just in case. You know, we're here now. We'll take care of you. We'll watch over you. We'll make sure you're safe. You know, we don't want any more of those Boston massacres, right? So, you know, you guys show us where your guns are. And we'll take it from here. And that's one of the things that led to the shot heard around the world.